From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat. It's Idaho Matters, and it is Friday. That means it's time for our reporter roundtable when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this week. Today, our panel includes Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, and Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, Samantha.
Hey, all right. Scott, let's kick it off with you. A federal court shot down Florida's transgender care ban, and this ban is apparently a lot like Idaho's, which is still being litigated. What happened in Florida? Let's start there.
Yeah, so a federal judge has permanently blocked Florida from enforcing its law that bans medical care for transgender adolescents. The ruling found that the state's ban on puberty blockers, hormones, and transition-related care for trans youth violated their constitutional rights when parents consent to such treatment. The judge stated that transgender identity is real and that denying safe, effective care solely based on being transgender amounts to discrimination and violates equal protection under the law.
It's a fascinating case, and you write about a lot of these bans across the country are sort of cookie cutter. Idaho's is a lot like Florida's.
Yeah, the Associated Press did a great story showing that a lot of these are just cut and paste model legislation that are in states all over the place. There's other cases in other states such as Montana, Tennessee, Kentucky, Arkansas, North Dakota, and they're making their way through their respective U.S. district courts. And a federal judge in Arkansas actually struck down that state's ban last year. So there is now precedent in two states, at least, that these bans are being struck down in the federal courts.
Do we know how this Florida and the other ruling might affect Idaho's ban and Idaho's court case?
Yeah, it doesn't have a direct impact, but the decisions provide a powerful legal precedent for the opponents who are challenging Idaho's ban on such things as puberty blockers, hormones, and transition-related surgeries for transgender minors. The Florida judge, interestingly, made arguments very similar to the ruling in December by the federal judge in Idaho's case. So in December, the judge in Idaho's case temporarily blocked Idaho's ban, making some of these same arguments about a violation of equal protection under the law and being discriminatory against a group a specific group of identifiable people. So the Florida ruling mirrors some of those arguments in that temporary block. But then in April, the U.S. Supreme Court lifted that block and allowed the Idaho's ban to go into effect in April. And so while these cases go up through the federal courts, it seems likely that these cases are going to end up at the Supreme Court. And it's a question mark how the Supreme Court is going to rule on these. But at least we've got two now. We now have two precedents in federal court overturning these bans on constitutional grounds.
And as you said, wait and see, because it's probably going to end up at the Supreme Court.
Probably.
All right. Kevin and Melissa, the Phoenix lawsuit had its day in the Idaho Supreme Court on Thursday. Speaking of Supreme Courts, Kevin, a little history of how we got to this point for folks who haven't followed along or are jumping in the middle with Phoenix.
Yeah, this is kind of like Christmas morning after covering this issue for a year. So the lawsuit goes back almost a year. Raul Labrador, Attorney General Labrador, filed this lawsuit back in June of 2023. He said that the State Board of Education violated open meetings law by discussing the U of I's plans to acquire the University of Phoenix in a series of closed executive sessions. The lawsuit really is about open meetings, but the implications are far more significant even than that. This lawsuit, just because it's been going on now for a year, has basically stymied the University of Idaho's plans to go out into the bond market and try to finance a deal. They don't have a deal in place right now with Phoenix or its owners anyway, but with the cloud of this lawsuit and now with the cloud of this appeal, it would be impossible for U of I to go out and finance this deal. And depending on what happens with the Supreme Court and when it happens with the Supreme Court, that could further complicate a deal that right now is in serious jeopardy.
Melissa, weigh in. I know you've been covering some of this too and watching it happen.
To Kevin's point about broader implications, this doesn't, one of the key questions here yesterday was, when do preliminary negotiations stop? And, you know, preliminary negotiations are a covered exemption under the Idaho open records or open meeting law. So depending on how the justices rule, this could have implications on what gets closed in the future. And that's something as a press corps that, you know, we pay close attention to. You know, the only thing journalists really advocate for is government transparency and access. And so this is something, you know, the University of Phoenix acquisition is obviously a huge deal for the university and for Idahoans as a whole. But there are other implications here about future open meetings and about, you know, future negotiations, depending on how the court rules on what constitutes preliminary negotiations and whether those negotiations stop when there's an offer on the table, or as the state board's outside attorney was arguing about, those preliminary negotiations only stop when contract negotiations begin.
Right. Yeah. And that was what was so interesting, Melissa, you were listening to on Thursday. I mean, that's what struck me on Thursday. This was really the first time we heard that debate in a courtroom, because at the district court level, District Judge Jason Scott basically took that question off the table. He basically said preliminary negotiations, in effect, cover all negotiations. So that never really was adjudicated at the district court level. So not surprisingly, the Supreme Court spent a lot of time trying to parse out, when do we go from preliminary negotiations to final negotiations? And it'll be very interesting to see where the Supreme Court comes down on that, because, as Melissa said, very serious implications for journalists and for the public going forward.
Well, and I would think for folks who are entities having closed meetings, with what you can talk about in the closed meetings and when they need to be opened up. I mean, that's what we're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And big questions about what the legislature initially intended when it wrote this. You know, most exemptions in open meeting and public records law are narrow, and they were meant to be narrow. And so there was a lot of discussion yesterday about the legislature's original intent decades ago when it wrote this statute about preliminary negotiations and competition, you know, during these bidding processes. There was a lot of discussion about plain meaning and grammar. And I mean, ultimately, it was a pretty wonky conversation, but the implications boil down to how taxpayer money is being used and how transparent government entities need to be when they're discussing making these very, very expensive purchases. This isn't just a State Board of Education factor. You know, just this week, the Ada County Prosecutor's Office found that the Ada County Highway District violated Idaho's open meeting laws while they were looking into buying a new headquarters. This came after Boise Dev raised the conversation. So totally different issue, but it all boils down to how transparent do government entities need to be when they're making multi-million dollar purchases?
So I don't cover the state Supreme Court that closely. I don't know the justices very well. I would not presume to be able to crawl into their heads and give you a sense of where they seem to be leaning. But I was struck on Thursday, and Melissa, you were listening too. I was struck by the questions that the justices were asking, because I thought they had tough questions on both sides of the issue. Justice Colleen Zahn talked a lot about legislative intent, and she was very clear in her questioning that she said that it feels like the legislature intended to allow some level of closed door negotiations to allow the state some kind of competitive advantage in bidding for a project or an acquisition like Phoenix. Justice Gregory Moeller asked a lot of tough questions about the process and the transparency of the process. At one point, and I quoted this in the story, that I did on Thursday, he talked about, okay, closed negotiations, private negotiations are a great way to run a business, but I'm agonizing right now about whether that's a good way to run a state. So definitely, you know, sentiments on both sides coming from the justices. So it makes it a little bit hard to read where exactly they would be coming from, where exactly they will be coming from when they do issue a ruling at some point down the road.
Any timeline for that? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, just to add, it's going to come down to two things. It's going to come down to the definition, the interpretation of what a preliminary negotiation is and when that ends. And also, I think the timeline of when these decisions were made, whether they had already made that decision and moved on to, finalizing that bid, that offer, before they opened it up to the public. And those are things I'm going to be watching closely, not just for the Phoenix implications, but for what that means for open meetings in the future.
Regardless of what the Supreme Court does, just really quickly, the U of I is now in a very dicey position in terms of trying to close this deal, because at this point, the U of I's asking price is now a matter of public record and has been now for a year. We know the U of I was willing to pay $685 million mm-hmm. to acquire the University of Phoenix. So any advantage that they received in the process of negotiating behind closed doors, that's completely out the window. Any university system in any state in the country that has any interest in acquiring the University of Phoenix, and I don't know if there are any out there that are looking at this acquisition, anybody now knows what the U of I's asking price is and can come in, a few million dollars higher if they choose to.
And so this really is now in limbo, right? The possible acquisition.
Yeah, it's definitely in limbo, and it has been for a while. And basically, May 31st was a date we were watching closely because that was the opt-out date that U of I could walk away from the table at that point. Phoenix or its owners could have walked away from the table at that point if there was no deal in place. Obviously, no deal in place. But the two sides, U of I says that they're going to be talking at least until the end of June. So I guess we'll check back in the end of June to see what's going on. But really important to note that Phoenix and its owners, Apollo Management, have said that they would like the option of maybe talking to other potential buyers. They're willing to stay at the table possibly, but they would maybe like to be allowed to talk to other bidders, get out of any kind of exclusivity arrangement with the University of Idaho. So a lot of uncertainty surrounding this deal.
And no timeline for a decision, right? Supreme Court can come down anytime.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. Kevin, back to you. Idaho Launch. You're seeing some numbers of how many Idaho kids are actually using the program. Quick reminder, what is it? What does it do?
Idaho Launch is a program that basically will allow students, high school graduates, to continue their education if they pursue what falls under the state's definition of an in-demand career. So they can get up to $8,000 that they can put towards college, or they can put towards work training, any number of things. We've known all along that this is a popular program with students. I mean, the applications were coming in fast and furious and in much higher numbers than even state officials expected. But what we now know is about 8,000 kids have received a contingent offer for a grant, and the state is working now to try to get more awards out, really even as we speak. We're eventually going to see about 9,250 students receive a launch grant, and then we're going to get to see what happens at that point. It's going to be really interesting to see, what does this do in terms of college enrollment? Does this lead to an uptick in enrollment? Because a lot of these kids are planning to use launch money to go to a two-year college or a four-year college. So do we have an uptick in college enrollment? Do we have demand on programs, specific programs in higher ed, like nursing has been a really popular program for launch applicants? Just a lot to see. And what we're really trying to see down the road, I think what everybody's looking for in terms of the big policy questions that we'll want to answer in the years to come, does this improve Idaho's college post-secondary go-on rate, which has been low for years? It's like 43% last year. Does that number move up? And do these students do they go into the workforce in Idaho in a couple of years? Do they stay in Idaho, or do they take their skills and go someplace else? Because, you know, if you've got, you know, skills in nursing or welding or auto repair, you can get a job anyplace in America if you choose to move someplace else. So a lot to watch for in the years to come. But you know, I just wanted to take a step back and get a look at the numbers that we're looking at right now.
Well, let's look at a few numbers and impact. And this is a slice, of course, but I'm going to quote from your article. A year ago, barely a quarter of Frank Church's seniors, Frank Church High School, went on to college. This year, 84% of students applied and 60% plan to enroll. That would seem to indicate, at least for Frank Church kids, a big impact.
And it's important to look at Frank Church is really interesting because it is an alternative high school. And those college go-on numbers that we've seen at Frank Church in years past, not terribly out of line with what you've seen with alternative high schools in the past. What folks who support Idaho Launch talk about is, will this program get a new group of students to think about continuing their education after high school? That's going to be really interesting to try to tease out and get a sense of. Another really interesting set of numbers, and I wrote about this earlier this month, and I wrote about it again on Thursday. The GPA of students who applied for Launch grants, it's a little bit lower than the state average GPA for high school seniors. And why folks like Wendy Sechrist, the head of the Workforce Development Council, who's basically the person administering Launch right now, the reason they look at those numbers and say that's good news is because it suggests that you've got students now thinking about life after high school who wouldn't think about it otherwise. I mean, they're not students with, you know, a 3.9 GPA or a 4.0 GPA, you know, kids who are just hardwired to go to college. These are students who, you know, sometimes they just they graduate and they tend to go right into the workforce, which, you know, it may not be the best long-term play for them. So the hope, you know, that you hear from folks like Wendy Sechrist is we're getting kids interested in continuing their education, you know, kids who would not have otherwise been interested.
Well, so if the numbers that finally come in, it looks like almost half of Idaho seniors will get Launch money this year. And I think that's important because there's no guarantees this program's going to continue, right? It's got critics.
It has critics in the legislature. It barely passed in 2023. It passed, the budget for this year passed the legislature, but narrowly. There was quite a bit of opposition. And I would expect that there's going to be continued opposition and continued questions at the legislature. I mean, we've talked about this before, how it looks like perhaps the Republican caucuses in the House and Senate are moving a little bit further to the right. That might translate to more critics or more skeptics about Launch. This is going to be a highly scrutinized program for years to come. This is just the beginning of the debate over Launch.
All right, Scott, Melissa, and Kevin, the Teton Pass collapsed. This is really, really scary. We're going to post an amazing picture of this on our website if you haven't already seen it. Scott, let's start with the pass for folks who haven't driven it. Where is it? What is it? What happened?
Yeah, the Teton Pass is a high mountain pass. And when I say high mountain pass, it's like 8,400 feet in elevation. It goes through the Teton Mountains in western Wyoming. It's along it's on the Wyoming side. It's a few miles into the over the border in Wyoming on Highway 22, and it's a I don't want to say major, but it's a main thoroughfare between Idaho and Wyoming. It provides a key route for tourists who are visiting popular resort destinations like Jackson Hole and Grand Teton National Park. A lot of people from Boise, as we're going to hear from Melissa and Kevin, have traveled this route. But it's also, it's a vital commuter link for about 2,500 workers who travel from Idaho to jobs in Jackson. As some of you probably know, Jackson Wyoming is a rather expensive place, and a lot of workers, particularly service workers, can't afford to live in Jackson, so they live in Victor. And this is really the only viable and short way for them to get from Victor to Jackson. And on June 8th, last Saturday, the road collapsed in the middle of Teton Pass. And like you said, a very dramatic images from the scene, the road just in a landslide collapsed and washed away, closing this really important connector between Idaho and Wyoming.
Well, and if you haven't driven it, but you've driven maybe any of Idaho's mountain roads, just imagine going down something like Highway 55, going around one of those curves, and suddenly the road is gone, literally gone, down the side of a cliff. So for the scary part, Melissa and Kevin, you both went over the Teton Pass just a few days before it went away.
Sure did. Both Kevin and I had signed up for a half marathon in Grand Teton. I'm not bragging here, but maybe just a little bit. And we had gone separately with our families, and Kevin drove over the pass on Saturday. I drove over it with my kids on Monday on my way home. And you know, when you drive the pass, it's like so many mountain roads in Idaho. You know, we've all driven Highway 55 on our way up to McCall. And I think we're used to it. We take it for granted. And then when Kevin sent me the article about the pass collapsing on Saturday, it was a holy moly moment, except I didn't say moly out loud. It really is a reminder that, you know, one of the trade-offs of recreating and living in mountainous areas is this is a real risk. And thank goodness no one was hurt. But what an eye opener.
Yeah, I can't repeat what I first said when I saw those pictures because it's a family radio show, but it's really shocking. And again, thank goodness nobody was killed in this, because a lot of things went right leading up to this landslide. If that's, that may sound hard to believe. They had a mudslide on that highway a couple of miles up from the landslide site the day before. And that's why they closed the road. So there was nobody driving on the road that morning when the landslide occurred and that section of highway basically fell into the valley. So thank goodness nobody was killed. But I think it's kind of a wake-up call. Again, I don't think we think about infrastructure. I know I don't think about infrastructure. We kind of expect that we have safe, reliable ways to get from point A to point B until we don't have it. And that's kind of what the folks in Teton Valley, Idaho, are dealing with right now. This for right now is a very major inconvenience and a very major hardship for that part of the state, because there are so many people who live in Idaho who work in Wyoming who can't afford to work in Wyoming. I mean, Jackson Hole is bonkers expensive. So they live in Idaho and commute over this pass, but now they don't commute over the pass. They have this kind of windy roundabout way to get to work. Yeah. And never mind. What's that?
The difference in the commute is about a half hour taking the Teton Pass route. And now it's an hour and 40 minutes to take this southerly route that goes around and to the south, and then has to come back to the north to get into Jackson. So you're talking about a difference of, you know, 25 minutes to a half hour to get to work, and now an hour and 40 minutes to get to work in Jackson. It's really dramatic.
And if you're an hourly worker in the service sector job, at some point you have to look at it and say, the cost and the time that it's taking me to get to my job, it's just not worth it anymore. So it'll be interesting to see, depending on how long it takes to get the pass reopened in some fashion, what kind of impact this is going to have on the economy in Jackson Hole, what kind of impact it's going to have in terms of workers in Teton Valley, Idaho. There's a lot to watch on this story.
Wow. Well, I'm glad everybody's okay. Glad you two made it over the pass and home safe. Melissa, yesterday was the first day of the Idaho GOP convention. but we don't have, we sort of know what happened maybe, but not really, because nobody could come and watch who wasn't a part of the convention. Talk about the media not getting in.
Right. I've been covering GOP conventions since 2012, and it used to be that reporters were allowed to sit in on the committee meetings, you know, the where they talk about what the platform should be, when they talk about who the delegates should be, who get a vote on, you know, these platform things like that. Over the past several years, we have seen a trend where those committee meetings are being closed to reporters. And that's the case, unfortunately, this year. The reporters who are there from Idaho Reports and East Idaho News and Idaho Capital Sun are all being told to wait in the hallway. They can still talk to delegates. They can still do interviews before and after sessions. But there was a question yesterday as to whether or not they could even go to the general session at which they'll vote for the next GOP chairperson. The current chair, Dorothy Moon, said that this is a private organization. It doesn't, and you know, she is right about that, but it bucks precedent. And it's considering how much power and sway this private organization, the Idaho GOP, has over legislation that gets passed in how people vote in the state house. We were really hoping for more transparency. I did get word from my reporter this morning that media will be allowed into the general session on Saturday, so we will be able to see how those votes play out. But I mean, I'm not kidding. I'm getting texts as we speak from reporters talking about issues that we are running into. I've been trying to text people back while on the radio show about people who are trying to interview the delegates and they're running into issues. It's deeply concerning, you know, that we don't know exactly what's going on, considering how much impact the Idaho Republican Party has on what ultimately becomes law in this state.
Okay, shameless promotion. We will have one of those reporters who's been stuck in the hall with us on Monday to talk about their experience and about what happened at the convention. So be sure to tune in for that on Monday on Idaho Matters. Kevin, the Idaho Board of Education has decided how many days or hours kids have to be in school in a given year, and why was this a big deal this year?
Well, this kind of brings to a head a debate that we started to see unfold during this legislative session. As part of that big school facilities law that went into effect, there was language that pertained to four-day schools that raised a lot of concern among the four-day school districts and charters around the state. You know, concerns that these new requirements in terms of classroom days might make it impossible to continue to work under a four-day calendar, to offer, you know, four-day school calendars that are popular in a lot of communities, by the way. What the state board did this week was they basically set a minimum classroom day requirement of 152 instructional days. But that isn't as hard and fast as it sounds, because a school can meet the requirement either through that 152 days or through minimum classroom hours, which have been in effect for years. So the change that the state board made might be fairly cosmetic and may not have a whole lot of an impact. But it, like I say, this has been a kind of a surprise debate as part of the facilities law. And it kind of underscored the popularity of four-day calendars around the state and the prevalence of four-day calendars around the state.
I was a little amazed by this from your story. More Idaho school districts are on four-day weeks than five-day weeks?
Yeah, a majority of schools and charters operate on a four-day calendar, and for a lot of reasons. You know, in past years, schools have gone to a four-day calendar thinking that it would save money. It really doesn't, because your fixed expenses, namely salaries and benefits, those don't change on a four-day schedule as opposed to a five-day schedule. But what they've found along the way is that a lot of teachers and staff really like the four-day schedule. It's kind of an inducement. It helps recruit and retain staff. It's popular in the communities because, you know, parents and students, they have that extra day to do whatever. They can, you have that extra day that you can spend, working on the farm, or you can spend it, on a job if you're a high school student, what have you. So that the scheduling flexibility is definitely an inducement. It's definitely one of the things that people point to when they point to the 4-day schedule. Like I say, there are communities that have been on this calendar now for a lot of years. It's been, more prevalent in rural Idaho, but we just saw NAMPA earlier this year announced that they will adopt a 4-day calendar starting next school year. They are by far the biggest school district to go to the 4-day schedule. So this is no longer just a trend that we see playing out in a few scattered small communities and rural districts. This is definitely a trend that's here to stay in Idaho education.
And continues to grow, apparently.
Yeah, definitely.
Scott, will we be getting a new casino 45 minutes from Boise? And why is this controversial?
Yeah, this is it's up in the air. It remains to be seen. The Shoshone Bannock tribes, which is based near Pocatello in Fort Hall, so a little farther east, they purchased land in 2020 to build a $300 million casino resort southeast of Mountain Home, pretty close, 45 minutes from Boise. It's a pretty massive project that they're proposing. It's 500,000 square feet and includes a casino, hotel, restaurants, event center, bowling alley, movie theaters, even a horse racing track, which I think is very interesting. However, another tribe, the Shoshone Paiute tribes of the Duck Valley Reservation, are urging authorities to reject the proposal. Now, the Shoshone Paiute in Duck Valley is a little bit closer. They straddle the Nevada-Idaho border, but they're a little bit closer to Mountain Home. And they argue that the proposed casino site is actually on their ancestral territory. And they say that Mountain Home is really, they have close ties to Mountain Home. This is where they shop. This is where their people have been born. They've received medical care there. They held their funerals. They've been a part of Mountain Home community for decades. And the Shoshone Paiute tribes have been working on their own plans for a casino in that same area since the 1990s. They had begun plans for a casino at a site just across the highway of the Shoshone Bannock proposal. But as the Shoban's plans move forward, the Shopai's investors started pulling out. And so the Shopai tribe has been they've been in discussions in the past to be a partner on the Shoban's plan, but they were relegated to a minority status of the ownership of the casino. And so those talks and that partnership has died down. So the Shopai is urging Governor Little and Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland to reject the proposal on those grounds that this is their ancestral territory and they have closer ties to Mountain Home. There's also been talk about, well, can you have two casinos? And really, the financial analysis is that however popular it might be, there's this town ain't big enough for the two of them. So they really are saying that it's got to be one casino. You can't have two. It just wouldn't financially pencil out.
So we'll probably get a casino, but we don't know who's going to build it.
Yeah, it still remains to be seen. I think the big question for me is whether the Sho-Pi tribe will be able to place enough political pressure on Secretary Haaland and Governor Little to make them say, yeah, we are not going to approve this as is. Now, they could, say, yep, go ahead and go with the Shoban plan and do it. But I suspect Secretary Haaland and Governor Little will say, well, because there's another tribe involved here that opposes it, we need to get you guys to the table because we're not gonna approve something when you've got this opposition from a tribe. And then in which case, I think they will be forced to the table and, probably have to negotiate some better deal so that all parties are happy. Otherwise, it might be dragged out even longer. So we'll have to see.
Interesting, interesting. Okay. Kevin, it's been more than a decade since the state revamped its graduation requirements. I did not know that. What are we looking at and why? Why the change?
Well, we're looking at changes, but we're not looking at changes overnight. I mean, what we're talking about here may not go into effect until the class of 2028 or the class of 2029. But what you're seeing the State Department of Education, the Idaho Department of Education, talking about right now are changes that will try to make high school graduation grad requirements sync more with career readiness. One of the things they're talking about doing is revamping the senior project. You know, every senior has to do a project. They want to try to make that project a little bit more career oriented and a little bit more aligned to careers. The same thing with electives. They want to figure out ways to make electives a little bit more aligned to future career plans. So that's sort of a flavor for the changes that Department of Education is talking about. They've been holding hearings and continue to hold hearings around the state. There is a survey that's available for people to provide feedback. Survey is geared more towards school staff, but the general public can also weigh in on the survey. And we have a link to the survey and a story kind of running down the details of what's being talked about. All of that's on our website at idahoednews.org.
And we'll put a link to that. It was interesting because there was some concern about some of these changes because of some staffing issues. I mean, there are just some schools that don't have the staff to help accommodate some of these possible changes.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you change graduation requirements, and we've heard this in the past, anytime you try to add a new credit or a new requirement, or you try to add a prerequisite, it's tough. Especially for districts that are struggling with staffing issues anyway. So I suspect there's a reason why we're talking about doing this for the class of 28 or 29. It's a complicated process. And like you say, it's been over a decade since the state has tried to undertake it. This is not something you do casually.
Well, and this is, an indication, and you talk about this, of changes in the way that we're looking at post-high school life and what you're going to do. When you get, I mean, I don't know how else to describe it, but, you know, right?
No, you're absolutely right, Sam. I mean, we talked about Idaho Launch in one of the segments earlier. I mean, this all does tie together. I think what you've got is, you know, a lot of factors that are coming into play, all kind of focused on the same thing. How do we make high school more relevant to students so that they're, you know, better prepared for what comes after high school and more motivated to take a path post-high school that continues their education in one form or another.
And that will benefit them as they go on. And as we've mentioned in both the stories, Idaho Launch and this one, that will benefit the state. I mean, a lot of this is about what does Idaho need in the future and what it's hoping to get from its graduates, whether it's from high school or college or
right.
some
and
other.
What are employers looking for as they try to fill positions, especially in some of these hard to fill professions? Yeah, it all does tie together.
And to pull from that group, from Idaho folks who are already here and have a life here and hopefully keep them in the state as opposed to trying to recruit from other states.
Right. And there are just some jobs and there are just some occupations that you really can't recruit from out of state. I mean, you really do have to rely on a robust labor pool in town, in state, because you're not going to draw from California or Seattle to fill some of these positions.
Okay. Scott, I know you're jumping up and down. We can't see you do it, but because it's radio.
I am.
You now have an NHL hockey team that you told me is 4 hours and 54 minutes from your house.
I mapped it, Sam. I am very excited about having NHL hockey this close. This is the Utah Hockey Club. They're going to begin playing in the 2024-2025 NHL season, which begins in October. I don't think they have a schedule set yet, but Ryan Smith, the owner of the Utah Jazz NBA team, he bought out the owners of the Arizona Coyotes based in Tempe and acquired the team and is moving them to Salt Lake City. And they're going to play their home games in the Delta Center, which is currently the home of the Utah Jazz. And I mapped it, and it is 4 hours and 54 minutes from my house. Of course, in good weather, in the winter, it might be a little longer than that. I'm calling it the Utah Hockey Club because that's actually going to be its name for the first year. You probably remember the Washington Redskins when they changed their name. They got rid of Washington Redskins and became the Washington football team before they became the Washington Commanders. It's going to be the same thing for this first season. They're going to be called the Utah Hockey Club. They are looking for a name, and they're asking people to vote in. And there's still time to vote for what you want this name to be. They had a bunch of names like the Utah Frost and the Utah Ice, the Utah Powder, the Utah Mountaineers, Utah Freeze. They came down with six finalists, which people are voting on right now. You've got the Utah Blizzard, the Utah Mammoth, the Utah Outlaws, the Utah Venom, the Utah Yeti, and for some reason, they still have Utah Hockey Club or Utah HC on the list. Personally, I favor the Utah Yeti, but voting is going to be open until June 20th. So if you want to have your say, log on to their website and vote for your favorite name. I'm going to stir the pot a little bit because we do have an ECHL hockey team here in Boise, the Idaho Steelheads, and they are currently affiliated with the Texas Stars of the AHL and the Dallas Stars of the NHL through the 24-25 season. Well, the Utah Hockey Club is affiliated with the Tucson Roadrunners in the AHL and the Utah Grizzlies in the ECHL. And the Utah Grizzlies, their affiliation, and for hockey fans, you're among your listeners, Utah Grizzlies are a arch enemy of the Idaho Steelheads. We're big rivals. And the Grizzlies are affiliated with the Colorado Avalanche. Their affiliation also expires in the 24-25 season. Now, it would probably make a lot of sense for the Utah Hockey Club to affiliate with the Utah Grizzlies, but I'll just throw it out there. Wouldn't it be cool if the Idaho Steelheads affiliated with the Utah Hockey Club just down the road? The Steelheads were a finalist to be an AHL, which is a step up from ECHL but below NHL, a couple of years ago to be the affiliate of the Seattle Kraken in Seattle, which was an expansion team a couple of years ago. And we lost out to the Palm Springs team, believe it or not, but they built a massive arena, multi-million dollar arena there, brand new arena. They have a bigger population center, and so we lost out on that bid. But I think we can still be in the mix, and people can talk about whether we can affiliate with another team and perhaps the Utica Hockey Club. But either way, I'm looking forward to driving just 4 hours and 54 minutes from my house to be at an NHL stadium watching an NHL game in Salt Lake next year.
I'm going to jump in quick, Scott. First of all, Utah Outlaws is the correct answer here. That would be my vote. But I'm excited about this too. I mean, I grew up in Long Island in the 1970s. I grew up with the Islanders. So I'm excited about this too. An NHL franchise in Utah is a license to print money. This thing is going to blow up. I mean, it's going to be a lot like what we've seen in Vegas and Seattle. This market down there is ready for NHL hockey, and I'm ready for it too. So I'll race you. I'll see if I can get down there
Well,
faster.
maybe we'll go together, Kevin, when we see the
We.
Utah Yeti play.
All right, we got to wrap it up. I want to thank our reporter roundtable this week. Thanks for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Samantha Wright. We'll see you tomorrow.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wild Card, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wild Card wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.